Thank you. It's very good to see. I see students. I see alumni. I also see people that I've never seen before. So this is great. This is a little different topic, not in the sense that it's a topic that's foreign to my research, but typically I try to pick out a problem that I'm working on a project, and I just try to explain in layman's term why I think it's an interesting problem. This is one that actually has started as a teaching problem. Next year, I'm going to start a new course at Carnegie Mellon. The title of the course is The Art and Science of Prediction. It's also with a colleague of mine at Carnegie Mellon. His name is Bob Lafferick. Well, we were starting to talk about some of the issues in data science, and one of the big ones that we see is that trying to get people to use the models and make good decisions with the models is actually separate from constructing the models. So we want to spend some more time thinking about the psychology, and that's actually one of the motivators here. So it's not so much that I want to give you lots of formulas tonight, but my goal is to try to make you aware of some of the cognitive limitations that people have as they use these models. So what inspired the title for this talk, I don't know if you realize, but each year, there's 1 month that's designated as the Mathematics Awareness Month. So this is where all the mathematics societies, IMS and the statistical societies come together, and they choose what's a really important problem that we want everyone to know that math is critical for. So this year, they designated the future of prediction. So you actually see prediction problems pop up all the time. And that's one of the things that I'd like to try to convey to you. As I said, the challenge is that you see prediction coming up all the time. If you think carefully about it, all the decisions that you make are predicated upon predictions. What am I going to have for dinner tonight? Well, I have a lot of choices that are available to me, and I sort of forecast out, what do I think my enjoyment's going to be? If I think about what job to take, or what investment to make, or what product to buy, again, all those are predicated upon predictions that I make about my own preferences or what I think the future is going to look like. We can also be very grand and think about what will the world be in 10 years from now. What will the climate look like? What will the economy look like? We could do this in 5 years or 10 years, or we could do this in 50 years. Don't need to worry about 100 years because I don't think I'll live that long. So I'll try to focus on the nearer term. The problem that we see is that most managers are ill-equipped to predict key events or numbers, having either the technical skills or the right mindset. So it's not just the models, but it's even being able to use the models. So the objective tonight is just to try to motivate some of the limitations that we have as human beings in our cognitive perception, and also to try to talk about some research that's been going on, not my research, but others that have been working in this area, on trying to allow people to become better forecasters. So the place to start is with the history. I promised the past of prediction, so I thought I would start out with the Oracle of Delphi. For those that don't know, this is a very famous oracle in ancient Greece. It was around for hundreds of years. It was situated in a very strategic location, and it was so well known that throughout the peninsula, all the way from Spartan to Thrace to Rome, people would travel to Delphi to know the future. One of the most famous instances is that Philip II of Macedonia came to the oracle, and he inquired of his future, and the priestess said, "With silver spirits you may conquer the world." Well, he understood this to mean that what he should do is go and conquer Thrace and take over the silver mines and use their riches to set the other city-states against one another. There was another famous prophecy about a black horse that he had that no one could ride, and the prophecy was that whoever rode the horse will take over the world. That was his son Alexander. So these are really good predictions. Unfortunately, the Oracle of Delphi is no longer available to us. It just so happens that the city sits upon a fault. And archaeologists have speculated that what made the Oracle omniscient is that there's an ethylene leak in this area. So when you breathe the fumes, they can cause hallucinations, or they can cause violent tremors. The other really clever thing about the Oracle of Delphi is that they didn't just rely upon the priestess. So the priestess would have these visions or sayings, but she didn't actually speak in a discernible way. They had other people around that would interpret. And they also had a network of spies throughout the peninsula, so they were well aware of what was going on. So this is not pure forecasting. This is also trying to think about what do I think is going to happen using some ordinary human intelligence. Here's another example of an early seismograph, a little more scientific. In each of the dragon's mouths is a little ball, and it can actually sense tremors, and the ball drops, so you can actually figure out what the direction of the tremors are going to be. Again, during the Han Dynasty, the forecasts were very accurate in thinking about astronomical events. Surprisingly, 100 years ago, people weren't quite as advanced. To try to know a person's future or attitudes, there was this thing called phrenology. It was the idea that the shape of your head is influenced by your mind, and if you could take certain measurements or if you could detect certain bumps in a person's head, you could tell what their future would be. Okay. Didn't work out so well. My point is that people have always asked questions about predictions, and this is critical to the decision-making that we have. I'm going to use terms like prediction and forecasting interchangeably. Forecasting usually is about a new event in the future. Prediction is going to be a cross-sectional event, but it doesn't matter to me. I'm going to use prediction in a broader sense for either of these. As I mentioned in the beginning, there are a lot of decisions that people make. Things like a bank has to make a decision about whether you qualify for a loan or not. They have to forecast the future. They have to forecast your future, and they also have to forecast the economic future to try to decide whether it's going to be profitable to them to lend the money to you. Will you repay it? Also, there's the question of what will the house be worth in 10 years or 20 years. So I read in the paper this morning the forecast of the real estate market in Hong Kong are projected to go down by 30%. Where does this number come from? Do you agree with it, right? We'll get to that in a minute. But there's a long list of predictions that underline business decisions that we make all the time. Companies, governments, economists, charities, university hospitals, everyone has to make these kinds of predictions. There's many notorious, famous predictions that have been made. Thomas Watson, chairman of IBM in 1943, said that, I think there is a world market for maybe 5 computers. So he was a little off. But again, you would expect that he would have great insight, given his expertise in computing. A Yale University professor had a student in his class named Fred Smith. You'll recognize Fred Smith because he went on to found a company known as FedEx. Fred proposed this idea of reliable overnight delivery service to his professor, and his professor responded back, "The concept is interesting and well-formed, but in order to earn better than a C, the idea has to be feasible." Clearly that was a bad one. I myself recall someone suggesting this idea of selling merchandise in the internet, and I asked, well, what kind of merchandise? Well, we'll sell secondhand merchandise, and I didn't think the idea sounded very interesting. That was eBay, and again, I have regrets about that one as well. Ken Olson, the president of DEC, said that there's no reason anyone would want a computer in their home, or Irving Fisher in 1929 declared that stocks have reached what looks like a permanently high plateau. Subsequently, the stock market drops off. Okay, so some of these are long-term forecasts, others are short-term. So how can experts make such terrible mistakes? Even if we take a look at the events of last week, we all know what happened in Turkey. How many of us had foresight in realizing that there was going to be a military coup? Well, I didn't occur to me. Turkey has a history of military coups, but it's been quite a while. And if you look around the Middle East, you would have thought that if anything was going to happen, it would have happened years ago, maybe during one of the elections. A political scientist, Jay Olfelder, who works in forecasting, has built models trying to predict a country's level of risk. And he actually placed this at a 2.5% probability of an attempted coup based upon 2016 data. So that placed the country way down on the list between Laos and Iran, and that's actually considered quite stable. Unlikely. The reports from the intelligence communities also that they were quite surprised as well. So how can our great minds, whose only job is to try to forecast what's going to happen, how can they do so poorly on forecasting what these events are going to be? Well, clearly there's this idea that some problems are irreducible and you just can't predict them, and others have a forecastable component to them. So how do we decide between what's irreducible and what's not? However, if you would have asked me last week how the Hague was going to rule, I could have guessed that it was going to rule against China in the South China Seas. But again, that was a lucky guess or maybe foresight based upon the Hague, how they usually rule. That wasn't as hard to make a prediction. What I'd like to point out is that we perceive the world, and our perceptions of the world have a huge impact on the way that we think about forecasts and predictions. And for us to really understand why predictions are so difficult, I'd like to start out with a trivia quiz. If we had time, I would have you take out pen and paper and answer these questions. However, for the quiz to really serve its purpose, we'll have to really examine one question in depth. The point of the 10 questions that you're about to see is to ask you trivia, but it's not to see whether you can get the answer right or wrong. It's for you to try to form a confidence interval. What I would like you to do is to think about each one of the answers to these questions, like Martin Luther King Jr.'s age at death. So how old was he when he was assassinated? Think about what his age was, and then I'd like you to form a lower bound and an upper bound. Now, the easy thing is to say, well, he was between 1 and 200, right? But that's too easy, because you'll get them all right. What you need to be able to do is build a tight enough confidence interval that if you do this quiz correctly, you're going to get exactly one question wrong. Okay, so that's your incentive for trying to form a tight bound around all of these things. So there's Martin Luther King Jr.'s age at death, the length of the Nile River, the number of countries that are in members of OPEC, the number of books in the Old Testament, the diameter of the moon, the weight of an empty Boeing 747. Let's pick that one. What I'd like you to do is think about what is your estimate of the weight of a Boeing 747, again, empty. And I'd like you to choose a lower bound and an upper bound that if you had enough time to answer all 10 of these questions, you think that would have only a 1 in 10 chance of being wrong. Now again, if you tell me 1 to a bazillion pounds, that's incorrect, because I know that you're going to get every one of these. So again, think about what would be a low estimate and a high estimate. Have you thought enough about it? Are you sure? Are you confident? Okay. Let me tell you what the answer is. The answer is 390,000 pounds. Now, I want you to be honest. How many of you had the answer 390,000 pounds exactly? It is a little tricky because there are different varieties of Boeing 747. Was it the initial incarnation, or am I talking about a 747-800, right? Am I talking about one with Rolls-Royce engines or GE? Okay. The bounds that you came up with, was that 380,000 within your bounds? How many people had it within their bounds? Oh, this is really bad. Okay. So what was your estimate? Were you over? Were you under? This is not atypical. Most people have overconfidence in their predictions. If you take the same trivia quiz and you give it to Harvard MBA students, and again, these are bright people, and you ask them to say, ideally, we want you to build 98% confidence intervals. So the ideal target is 2%. You'll actually observe that they get about half of them wrong. If you ask employees of a chemical company, in this case, these are chemical industry facts, and you ask them, the ideal target is 10% or a 90% confidence interval. Again, roughly half of those are wrong. It gets even worse when you ask them company-specific facts. You would think that the things that are less trivia to the things that you work with all the time, that you would be much better at predicting what these things are. And again, I'm not asking you to get the right answer. I'm just asking you to form an accurate bound. Managers of a computer company, again, they do awful, either around general or specific facts. Or if you ask a physician, and in this case, you ask the physician, okay, don't be wrong. Just give the most accurate prediction of whether this patient has pneumonia or not. What is the probability? Again, if it's my physician, I hope that's going to be 0%. It turns out that physicians get this wrong 82% of the time. So you miss the target, the probability. So what that's saying is that people are really bad. And why? Well, again, the answer is going to be overconfidence. We tend to put a lot more confidence in our knowledge than we really should. Let me give you another test. So a bat and a ball together cost $1.10. The bat cost $1 more than the ball. So how much does the ball cost? Quick, give me an answer.
50 cents.
Sydney, what do you think? 10 cents. That's a good answer. That's what most people say. That's my daughter back there. She's 8. So I won't call anyone else. I heard some people have the right answer of 5 cents, but most people come up with 10 cents. The reason is that this is a heuristic that we have. We get two numbers, and mental math, like subtraction, that's easy enough. But if you think about it, 10 cents can't be the right answer. Consider, if the bat is $1 and the ball is 10 cents, then $1 minus 10 cents is 90 cents. But the questions specifically say the difference is $1. Okay, so what happened? Well, the correct answer requires a little more math. You actually have two equations. Bat plus ball is $1.10. Bat is equal to ball plus $1. So if we subtract the first two equations from one another, that tells us that the ball is equal to 10 cents minus ball, or two balls is equal to 10 cents. And I can now figure out that the ball must be 5 cents. Okay, so some of you are really good at mental math, and others, I must admit, when I see this, I'm a little lazy. I say 10 cents, because I don't think very clearly about it. Here's another example. What is more likely to cause death in the United States each year? Lung cancer or motor vehicle deaths? Okay, what about pair number two? Tuberculosis or fire and flames? Okay, well, let's find out. It turns out that most people choose motor vehicle deaths and fires and flames. It turns out if you take a look at the newspaper, there are 3 stories about lung cancer deaths and 127 stories about motor vehicle deaths. There's no stories about tuberculosis, and there are 24 about fires and flames. So if you take a look at the actual number of deaths in the U.S. in thousands, it's 140,000 people die of lung cancer and 46,000 people die of motor vehicle deaths. Or if I ask you what's the probability of dying in a terrorist attack, people are utterly concerned, but they'll hop into the back of a taxi cab without a second thought. However, the chance of dying in a taxi cab is much greater than dying in a terrorist attack. Okay, at least in terms of the miles that you travel. So again, what's happening is there are biases. In the other, we use heuristics. We simplify problems, and that's great. Because if you think about the number of decisions that you have to make, go to your local grocery store, and imagine that you have to go down the aisle and pick out, a can of tuna fish. There are, 50 different cans of tuna that you could choose from, or other kinds of canned goods. If you spent 20 seconds picking up each package and reading the label and thinking about what's in those packages, that's 1,000 seconds that you would have to spend choosing that can of tuna. Just imagine if you buy 30 items, we would spend forever in the grocery store. Literally, we would spend hours. People would be moving up and down the aisles, and it would be incredibly laborious. And that's why we need these heuristics, so we can quickly make decisions. The only problem is that oftentimes the way that we form our estimates, we tend to be way off. How did you form your estimate of what you think a Boeing 747 weighed?
Trucks.
Okay. It's big, right? What does an elephant weigh? I don't know, right? I mean, you think about how big you are and how big the elephant are. So, I don't know, maybe 200 pounds. That sounds like a lot. Or 2,000 pounds, or 20,000 pounds, or 50,000. Okay, here's another example. This is called an anchoring heuristic. So if I ask you, is the population of Turkey greater than 30 million? Or if I ask you, is the population of Turkey greater than 3 million? You'll get very different answers. So the numbers themselves can influence the way that people respond. Marketers use this to great advantage because they'll have a suggested retail price. And what they're trying to do is get you to focus on that number, and then that's called an anchor, and then you're going to try to make an adjustment from there. So if I propose a really huge number, so the value of this camera is $20,000, and I'm going to offer it to you for $10,000, you say, wow, that's a great deal. On the other hand, if I offer it at $10,000 and charge you $10,000, you say, no, that's not a good deal at all. Okay. There's another problem that we run into. This is called a hindsight bias. Suppose I ask you right now, what's the probability that Hillary Clinton is going to win the U.S. presidential election? What would you tell me? Well, many of you might say 99%, but That's another kind of bias. That's where you conflate your hopes and expectations with what your forecast is going to be. I'm not big on Trump, so I'm afraid. Oftentimes you replace the answer to the question with another that's a little more desirable. But if I ask you next year, what was the probability that you came back with, most of your estimates are going to be way off. You're going to move the estimate to be much more favorable towards what the outcome was. So if I come back and ask you now and you say, I don't know, about 60%, and if I ask you next year, the chances will be more like 90%. So you tend to think very highly. You knew it all along. Here's another one. This is called a confirmation bias. You hear this all the time. Economists are awful at making predictions, right? Here's a plot of predictions of the actual GDP of U.S. economy on year-over-year percentage change rates. The red is the actual, and what you notice is that sometimes the economy shrinks. However, if you look at economists' forecasts, what do you notice? Economists never forecast a recession. So economists are awful in predicting, right? Okay, so the error of this statement is that we only consider what the forecaster got wrong, not what they got right. So if you go back and say the patient is cured, it proves my treatment works, but if the patient dies, then it means nothing, then you can't prove anything. You can't learn anything from data. So again, this is another example of a bias that people had. Let me ask you another question. This is another probability question. What's the chance that two people in this room have the same birth date? If I were to go back and make a wager with you, I'll put up $100, and if I'm right, I don't know, you pay me $1,000, and if I'm wrong, you give me the $100. Would you take that wager? Well, it depends. Do you think that the odds are more than 90% that there are two people in this room that have the same birthday, or do you think it's less than 90%? And if it's greater than 90%, then you'd take that bet. If it's less than 90%, then you wouldn't take the bet, right? Unless you're not a gambler, in which case you wouldn't take the bet under any conditions. But again, tell me, what do you think the chances that two people in this room have the same birthday? Let's start out at 50%. How many do you think it's at least 50%? Even? How many people want to go lower? Okay. How many people want to go higher? How many people voted twice? all right. So again, I promised that we wouldn't do a lot of math, but I've got to point out what you should have done is you should have said, how many different pairs of people are there in this room? If there are 60 people in this room, then that means that there are 1,770 unique pairs. Now, what's the chance that two people have different birthdays? Well, that's easy, assuming that every birth date has an equal probability. Forget about leap years for the moment. So that gives a 365 days. So that means that there's a 99.7% chance that people will have different birth dates. Right? I mean, this is a really big number. It's almost like 100%. So we can be almost certain that no one is going to have the same birthday as me, right? By the way, my birthday is October 6th. Does anyone have October 6th as their birthday? Okay, that proves the point, right? However, if we go back and think about what's the correct answer, I ask the question, what's the chance that any two people have the same birthday? So it's not just, do you have my birthday, but it's also, do you have Paul's birthday or Sydney's birthday or whoever else in this room? So there are 1,770 pairs, so what we really have to do is think about flipping a coin. It's like the coin comes up heads 99.7% of the time, and 0.3% of the time it comes up tails. So what's the chance of always getting heads? Well, if we multiply that together, that's a little less than 1%. So there's a 1% chance that no two people in this room would have the same birthday, which means that there's about a 99% chance that in this room, at least one pair of us has the same birthday. This is known as the birthday paradox, and the reason it's called a paradox is most people are very puzzled. It's like, that can't be right, right? That's not the way that you think about probabilities. Most people think about probabilities, and there are really three probabilities that people understand. More specific, but there are really two. There's yes, which is 100%, and then there's no, which is 0%. And then people usually have an idea about a probability that's still somewhere in between. But for the most part, your cognitive processing wants to try to round probabilities to either 100% or 0%. So when I ask what's the chance that two people in this room have the same birthday, 99.7% gets rounded to 100%. So it's like there's no chance that anyone in this room has the same birthday. So your heuristic just says, okay, 0%, doesn't matter how many pairs, it's going to be 0%. All right. So the problem is that people aren't really good with probabilities, which is bad because we want to think about predictive models which are relying on probabilities. So people are poor learners from experience. There's this confirmation bias that I'm only looking for things that confirm what I think. There are poor intuitive senses for the dollar value of money or information and also estimating probabilities. And people are also limited in biased information processors. In Daniel Kahneman, a Nobel laureate in economics and psychology, said that declarations of high confidence mainly tell you that an individual has constructed a coherent story in his mind, not necessarily that the story is true. So, again, just because I answer consistently just means that I've sort of convinced myself that that's the truth. It doesn't actually mean it is the truth. I like Will Rogers' quote. He was an American humorist and said, it's not what we don't know that gives us trouble, it's what we know that ain't so. In other words, we tend to miss the facts, but we believe what we say anyways. So if we're going to be better at making predictions, we've got to overcome our own biases. So we need to think about a systematic approach to making predictions. So some suggestions are we have to offer up a level of confidence that we have about predictions. So instead of just saying, do I think it's going to happen or not happen, I have to start offering probabilities. And I also have to go back and start keeping track of whether those probabilities are going to be correct or not. I've got to get feedback to you to figure out, is this good or bad? Surprisingly, in medicine, it's really only in the last 50 years, 60 years, that the idea of randomized trials has become the gold standard. If I would have asked my physician 100 years ago what's the right treatment, they wouldn't have thought on an empirical-based strategy of trying to figure out what's the right thing. So, again, this is critical, and oftentimes it just doesn't get done. In business, most of the time, you don't try to do both what you think is right and also what you think is wrong. You just do what you think is right. But if I only do one thing, I can't learn. You've got to ask yourself disconfirming questions. So instead of asking yourself the question of what's the weight of a Boeing 747, you've got to start setting up in a problem where you can start testing your knowledge and trying to figure out, okay, well, what's something that's bigger than a 747 that I know how much it weighs, or what's something smaller, and then let me try to go back and build up. You've got to expose hidden sources of future problems. You also have to limit yourself to the information that you can handle so you don't get overloaded, because if you get overloaded, then you start ignoring things and you rely more on heuristics. We also have to think real carefully about how to evaluate forecasts. And I know it sounds easy. Steve Ballmer made this statement. Ballmer was the CEO of Microsoft at the time. This was just 10 years ago, 9 years ago. It's surprising how short a time frame that the iPhone has been around and how much impact it's had. Ballmer said there's no chance that the iPhone is going to get any significant market share. No chance. What do you think? Did Steve Ballmer get it right? No, it sounds like an awful statement, but what he said is that there's no chance. It's a $500 subsidized item. They may make a lot of money, but if you actually look at the 1.3 billion phones that get sold, I prefer to have our software in 60% or 70% or 80% of them than I would have 2 or 3%, which is what Apple might get. Okay, so if you really start parsing out the language, what you find out when most people talk about predictions, they toss enough vague terms in there like maybe or significant or market. I mean, what is significant? Is that 2%? Actually, if you look at this on a global basis, Apple is only about 4 or 5% of smartphone phone sales. So he's not that far off, yet we think this is a ridiculous statement because we have our own perception about what the popularity of the iPhone is. So again, the lessons, we just need to be more precise in our forecast. And obviously probabilities are better, but we're not very good to deal with probabilities anyway. So again, this is a big challenge. Or if you go back to that trivia question that I asked, what's the weight of a Boeing 747? Fermi, a well-known physicist, had a system for trying to go back and decompose complex problems into component questions. So what he would often do is try to get people to try to decompose a complex problem to simpler statements and then try to attach some prior guesses about the simpler statements and then try to develop an overall forecast. His thought problem is, how many piano tuners are there in Chicago? No one knows this. Actually, no one really knows how many tuners there are. If you go back to the phone book and count them up, there are about 80. But what he wanted you to do was to try to think about, well, what's the population of Chicago? How many people have pianos? How often do pianos need to be tuned? How many pianos can be tuned? So you start taking the components, and all of a sudden you've got some reasonable guesses about each of those, and if you multiply it out. So like in the case of the Boeing 747, I've flown on a Boeing 747, and I know that if I'm the last one in that last aisle, there's about 45 rows of people, and there's about 10 people in each row. So if I multiply that out, that means that there are about 450 people that's on a Boeing 747. I know how much my car weighs, and if there are four people in my car, I could take that ratio and multiply it out, and I could come up with an estimate of 675,000 pounds. Is that a good estimate? Well, it's maybe better than some of the ones that you've come up with. At least it's an initial point, and you can try to start thinking about what's the right way to estimate it. You can also go back and think about how big it is and what the density is. So again, there are lots of ways, but the point is that if we want to be better at making predictions, we need to decompose the predictions. Okay, so what are some systematic suggestions? What we found, or what research has shown, is that you need to start with a baseline. You need to have a reasonable guess, and then you need to start making adjustments from that reasonable guess. And you've got to learn from data, and you have to learn from mistakes. You also need to be able to combine multiple and disparate pieces of information. It turns out that in statistics, the most systematic way of trying to process information is Bayes' formula. So Bayes' formula tells you, if you start with initial guess and then you get a new piece of information, how can I update this new piece of information? So this is a conditional probability. It turns out that we're not very good at conditional probabilities either. So here's an example. This is called the Monty Hall. Let's make a deal. This is another paradox. I don't know how many people are familiar with this show. It's an American game show that was really popular back in the 70s. There's Monty Hall. He's the host, And what he would do is he would call people in from the audience, and then he would let them choose one of three doors. And behind one of these doors would be a car, and behind the other door would be a goat, and then behind the other door would be some smaller prize. So clearly you want to choose the one where the car is at, right? So what he would do is he would try to dramatize it, and he would open up a door. And then he would ask the person, do you want to switch the door based upon the fact that I've opened up, say, door number three? Okay. What I'd like you to just think about this for a minute. If you were playing the game and you have three doors in front of you, what's the chance that you would have that you would choose the right door with the car behind it? Okay, it's one in three. Let's suppose that I open one of the doors. What's the chance now that the car would be behind the other door? So if you go back, most people think it's 50%. It doesn't matter, right? There's no reason to switch your guess. However, if you think about this carefully, what's the chance that the host is just randomly going to open the door? Well, the host knows where the car is at, so he's not going to choose the car. He also knows where the goat is at, so he's not going to reveal the goat, because that's not good TV, right? So what he's going to do is he's going to be strategic, and he's going to choose the door that has the medium gift. So now what's the probability? Well, it turns out that the probability is the host opens the door, and the odds for the two sets don't change, but the odds move from zero for the open door and two-thirds for the closed door. So that means that if you go back and think about you initially chose door number three, would you want to switch to one of the other doors? The answer is yes, absolutely. You always want to switch because of the two-thirds probability that you'll choose a better door. There's the math. I'll let you go back and look at it. But what's happening here is that our intuition is it doesn't matter, but it turns out that it does. And the reason is that the way that the door is being selected reveals some information. And oftentimes we're not very good at trying to integrate that information together. So even though we know Bayes' theorem, internally sometimes we don't do it well. All right, so what I'd like to do is just talk a little about some research, where we're at now, and also thinking about what the future is going to be. So here I pull out one of my research, because this was one of the things that got me started in thinking about forecasting. This was one of the early papers that I wrote. I spent a lot of time thinking about what the right forecast of the U.S. unemployment rate is going to be. So these are time series models. And again, if you take a look, usually the unemployment rate in the U.S. goes between somewhere between 3% and at a high, it might be 12%. If you go back, way back to the Great Depression, it's in the 20s, like 25%. And again, I know there are all kind of ways of measure unemployment, so this may not be the best way, but if you look at it, what you see is there's some shaded areas, and these are recessions. What you notice about unemployment is that it can go up very quickly, but then it tends to go down very slowly. So it tends to go down during expansions, but it tends to go up during contractions. So what I did in this paper is I estimated lots of different models. So there's one model here. It just takes patterns in the past, an autoregressive model, and tries to predict out in the future. So at each time point, you make a forecast, and you try to take your best guess about what are the long-term forecasts going to be. So over here, this simple model, if I'm down here in an expansion and unemployment seems relatively stable, if I forecast out in the future, I tend to be, I don't know, either up level or sort of down, but ultimately they start to smooth out. They tend to hit some point. most of the interest is going to be in the near-term forecast, or really you ask that question about what's the chance that unemployment is going to start changing dramatically. This is a model that's a little better because it picks up sort of the term, but it's always consistently making a mistake when you make these forecasts. At the time, I did a lot of work in nonlinear models because chaotic theory was very popular and novel in time series analysis. And what this does is, again, picks up a better pattern than the other two models. So this does better. It actually does much better for longer-term forecasts. There's another variation on known as a switching model, where you can have expansions and contractions, and there's probabilities, and you're going to forecast it out. However, it doesn't really do well better in long-term forecasts. You can also go back and ask experts. There's something known as a consensus forecast. So this is actually a survey of professional forecasters. That's what the SPF forecast stands for. And what you notice is that they always do pretty well for the near-term forecast, but they constantly mess up in long-term forecasts. And notice that economists always tend to be optimistic that the economy is going to come back to its level state. So the benefit of the models is the models are quite happy to go back and say unemployment's going to go up to 10%. But economists don't like to be that extreme. They like to have what's known as regression to the mean. So they like to try to pull it back. And the point is that no one does really well at trying to forecast turns. More recent work has shown, I should point out that the last 50 years of research in social sciences has shown that models tend to do a better job. If you've got a good model, it tends to do a better job than an expert or intuition. The defense or the intelligence community in the U.S. Has had lots of negative publicity, especially after 2001 and the terrorist attacks, that they totally messed up on it. And also in the invasion of Iraq, that they thought that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, and they were proven wrong. So the intelligence agency sponsored a project. They have a research arm, which is called IARPA, and they announced a forecasting tournament. Actually, this is very brave, and this is, if you want to be a better forecaster, you have to measure, and you've got to compare what you're forecasting to try to see whether you're doing better or not. And they had five teams that they sponsored, and the goal of each of the team was to answer 500 questions about world affairs. So the questions were constantly ongoing. They also had an internal team. Of course, they don't disclose the internal team. That was classified, but the other teams were public knowledge. And they were asking questions, things like, will war break out on the Korean Peninsula? Will the Nikkei close above 9,500? Will the price of gold plummet? Will protest in Russia spread? I think this is impressive. This is recent. What happened is one of the teams did such a great job that they actually shut the experiment down, or they got rid of the other four teams and they only chose one team. What was the one team they chose? It was called the Good Judgment Project team, and it was created by Melrose and Tetlock. And what they did was they went back and asked 20,000 people to participate. Many of these were just retired people or students or people that were interested in trying to do forecasts. They are not experts. They're not intelligence experts. They're ordinary people. But what they did was they went back and they scored the accuracy of each of those people, and they had them continue to update their forecast. And they chose the ones that did well, and then they called those super forecasters. And then they also asked the question, if you put groups of super forecaster togethers to create, can you do even better? And it turns out the answer is yes. They won the tournament by 60% in its first year and 78% in the second year. So again, what IARPA did was decide that they would only have these teams. So again, the question that you want to ask is, well, how do people get to be so good at forecast? It's not that they have some innate knowledge. It's just that they're open to possibilities. They're open to the possibility that they're wrong, and they're constantly asking themselves the question, did I get it right? And also constantly trying to integrate new information together. There's a popular idea called the wisdom of crowds. It's actually a fairly old idea. Francis Galton was a famous statistician, and he was at a country fair in England. And they had a booth set up at this country fair where you had to guess the weight of an ox. So what he did was he had people write down their guesses of the weight of the ox, and he recorded them all and did a statistical analysis on this. It turns out that the average of the 800 guesses was 1,197. The actual weight of the ox is 1,198. And he thought this was phenomenal. He thought, why would this work? You've got some experts, like you have a farmer who owns an ox, so he would have a pretty good idea. But then you've got average people like me. I have no idea how much an ox weighs. I know they weigh more than me. I don't know. Do they weigh 10 times as much as I do, or 5 times, or 20 times? Okay, so what he found is that the median was like a really good way. If you go back and get a bunch of people, so some people are just noise, but there are others that really have some knowledge. And if you can capture that knowledge, you do a much better job. This is also popularized by this book called The Wisdom of Crowds that came out and talked about how we can try to aggregate forecasts. So a really popular thing right now is that you can have these electronic markets. Research has shown that these electronic markets do well. But surprisingly, the Good Judgment Project, the super teams, they actually do better than the electronic markets. So there's still something about going back and looking at information and aggregating it together. Now, to be fair, some people say, well, the reason that the markets don't work is because you haven't given an incentive. If you give an incentive, then the markets will do better. There's some current research that's going on. Okay, so just to try to wrap up and pull us forward, when are predictive models going to work? Forecasting as a science really started in the 80s. And if you go back and try to figure out what is it about forecasting that makes forecasting work, it really boils down to three questions. You have to ask yourself, do you have an idea of what's driving it? Causation. Do you have some past examples to leverage data? And then you also have to ask your question, will my forecasts themselves affect what is that I'm trying to predict? So that's endogeneity or feedback. All right, so that drives the question of what works. I had a colleague at Wharton, his name is Scott Armstrong, and he was really interested in forecasting. He went back and wrote a book. It's called The Handbook for Researchers and Practitioners on the Principles of Forecasting. He worked with dozens of experts on trying to combine what they thought were good forecasting rules, and he reduced it into a mere 139 principles of forecasting. Okay, so that's pretty long. But he did boil it down to 20 golden rules of forecasting. And I mean, for most of these, they're pretty simple. Use all the important information. Avoid bias. Avoid unaided judgments. I mean, who's going to argue with those as principles of forecasting? Well, the thing is that he's gone back and has evaluated global climate research. Are there any climatologists here? Good. Okay. Because if there were any climatologists, they would be offended by these comments. But Scott has done is he said that the forecasts that are generated by climatologists are awful. He says that they violate 72 out of 89 principles that he could identify. So he comes back and says that, in effect, these are the opinions of scientists that are transformed by mathematics and obscured by complex writing. In fact, he goes further in other research and says, look, if you compare the forecast from these really complex models to a very simple hypothesis, which is that there's no change, this simple hypothesis that there's no change does a better job of forecasting. So if our goal is to choose the forecasts that are better, which one would you choose? In fact, he went back and ran another where he had an even conservative cooling hypothesis, and that actually fit the data better than the warming hypothesis. Yet no one discusses global cooling. Everything is about global warming. Okay, so my point is just that we have principles, we have models, but oftentimes we don't know what the models do, and we have a preference for the models. So, again, we're really in a bad situation because humans mess up on predictions because of cognitive biases, and sometimes models are so complex that we can't try to figure out how they work. But I wanted to end on a happy note, which a happy note is if you go back and take a look at numerical weather forecasts, they're actually doing a great job because they follow along with those predictions. The problem with global climate is that I can't run an experiment with the planet and let's see what happens. I can't wait 100 years to try to figure out whether the model's right or not. But we do have constant forecasts of temperatures, and what you're looking at here are different forecasts. So here's like a 3-day forecast, a 5-day, and a 7-day forecast. The rough rule of thumb is that you've got to be at least 80% accurate for people to really pay attention. So if you go back and take a look at the 10-day forecast, those are pretty bad. Even today, 10-day forecasts are pretty bad. But if you take a look at the 3-day forecast, those are actually really good. The 3-day forecasts have an accuracy of almost 98%. And in fact, if you take a look at the quality of the 5-day forecast, today, this is about as good as what the 3-day forecasts were 20 years ago. So in other words, we've gotten a lot better. And these are examples of very complex models that integrate lots of things together. So I don't mean to say predictive models are bad. I just mean to say that we need to follow along with good forecasting principles about coming up with good ones. So where does that leave us? Well, there's all kinds of innovations, new prediction markets that are coming online where you've got incentives. There are also meta models that are combining lots of different things like opinion polls and bookmaker odds to try to come out with what are the right forecasts. In machine learning, there are these ideas of ensemble learning methods where you take lots of models and combine them together. Just like the wisdom of the crowds, well, this is the wisdom of crowds of models, not crowds of people. So methods like bagging and boosting and model averaging and stacking, all these can generate better forecasts. Or the last one, which is something that I'm starting to work on, is something called probabilistic programming. Well, you know programming. However, programming with computers only allows for a very discrete, fixed logic. Programs aren't good about trying to say, well, there's some probability that this variable is going to be 2. It's either 2 or it's not 2. It's not a probability. But what probabilistic programming is doing is trying to incorporate these laws of probability in these statements to try to get computers to be more Bayesian or to be able to represent these kinds of problems. Turns out that they can actually do a pretty nice job. One example that I had was trying to show a learning example. Like on the internet, they give you these CAPTCHAs to try to guess what the letters are. So it turns out that the computer can do a pretty good job with a fairly limited number of rules. Just give enough examples, and it learns. It figures it out using Bayes formula. Or here's another example where you've got input images, and you want to try to train to figure out what are the edges of the roads. So in the future, your car is going to have to detect where the roads are at. If your car is 99% accurate, is that good enough? no, not for my car. That means that there's a 1% chance that it's going to go off the road. And if it goes off the road, that's a very bad outcome. So 99% means that if I drive every day, there's a few days out of the year that I'm going to get off the road. So no, we can't tolerate a 99% accuracy. My concluding thoughts are that prediction is really important, both internally as well as policy statements and a business statement. However, we're not really good at forecasting. It's not that we don't know the rules of probability. It's just that the way that we interpret statements, the way we look at data, often can be biased because of our cognitive perception. So we can be more systematic about trying to overcome these. And that's one of the good things about models. But models are formed based upon assumptions. And just like our predictions can be wrong, our assumptions can be wrong. So again, we've got to continue to update and learn about these things. I will point out that many of the things that I mentioned are covered in some recent books. These are really good books. I would encourage you, if you're looking for some good summer reading, one is by Daniel Kahneman, who is a Nobel laureate in economics. It's called Thinking Fast and Slow. There's another book by Tetlock and Gardner on super forecasting, the art and science of prediction. This talks about the good judgment project and what makes for good forecasters. There's another book on Bayesian theory. This is about the theory that would not die. And then there's another book on predictive analytics that just has been revised. So I'll leave it here. Again, my thought is just that predictive modeling is really in vogue. It's incredibly important. It's just oftentimes our predictions can be way off, and we just have to continue to learn. Thank you. I think maybe I've got a minute to take questions, if anyone has questions.